Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Wednesday, January 19th, 2022. President Joe Biden holding a news conference to mark a year in office, touting what he says is a strong record on economic recovery from the coronavirus pandemic, as well as getting a handle on the Omicron variant, also curbing inflation, and foreign affairs confronting Russia, which has massed troops on the border of Ukraine. U.S. Senate taking votes on whether to change the filibuster rule to pass voting rights bills without needing to clear a 60-vote threshold. But even before the voting begins, Democratic Senator Joe Manchin makes it clear he will not support the change, dooming the effort, since all 50 Democratic Senate caucus members are needed. Supreme Court hearing a case involving Senator Ted Cruz's re-election campaign, whether a limit on using political contributions to repay a candidate's personal loan to his campaign violates the First Amendment's right to free speech. And the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson under increasing pressure to resign over his role in attending parties during COVID lockdowns, one member of parliament from Johnson's own party telling him, "In the name of God, go." We'll get the latest from a reporter in London with Business Insider. Heading to President Biden's news conference, the Washington Post writes it's happening on the eve of his first anniversary in office, and the president is, quote, seeking to highlight his administration's progress amid the ongoing coronavirus pandemic, a stalled legislative agenda in Congress, and a showdown with Russia over Ukraine. And this from Fox News, as the president marks 12 months in office, his standing with Americans remains underwater. Averages of the most recent national polls compiled by both Real Clear Politics and 538 put Biden's approval at 42% and disapproval at 52%. President Biden opened with some thoughts on the economy and COVID-19.
Tomorrow will mark 1 year since I took office. It's been a year of challenges, but it's also been a year of enormous progress. We went from 2 million people being vaccinated at the moment I was sworn in to 210 million Americans being fully vaccinated today. We created 6 million new jobs, more jobs in 1 year than any time before. The unemployment rate dropped to 3.9%. Child poverty dropped by nearly 40%, the biggest drop ever in American history. New business applications grew by 30%, the biggest increase ever. And for the first time in a long time, this country's working people actually got a raise. People, the bottom 40%, saw their income go up the most of all that got a raise. We cut health insurance premiums for millions of American families, and we just made surprise medical bills illegal in this country. You know those bills you get that you don't expect of $2,000 to $5,000 from the hospital beyond what you thought you were going to have to owe because of the consultation you weren't told was going to cost that much? No more. They're now illegal. Thanks to the American Rescue Plan and other actions we've taken, we've seen record job creation, record economic growth in the past year. Now, thanks to the bipartisan infrastructure bill, we're about to make a record investment in rebuilding America to take us to be the number one best infrastructure in the world. Well, now we're way below that. We'll be creating better jobs for millions of people, modernizing our roads, our bridges, our highways, our ports, our airports, everything from making clean water, removing lead pipes, that every American can turn on a faucet and drink clean water. Urban and rural and suburban communities. It's going to make affordable high-speed internet available to every American in urban, rural, and suburban areas. We've never done that before. Now we are. We're in the process of getting that done. Still, for all this progress, I know there's a lot of frustration and fatigue in this country. And we know why. COVID-19. Omicron has now been challenging us in a way that it's the new enemy. But while it's cause for concern, it's not cause for panic. We've been doing everything we can, learning and adapting as fast as we can, and preparing for a future beyond the pandemic. All I know that after almost 2 years of physical, emotional, and psychological weight of this pandemic and the impact it's had on everyone, for many of us, it's been too much to bear. We're in a very different place now, though. We have the tools. Vaccines, boosters, masks, tests, pills to save lives and keep businesses and schools open.
Part of President Biden's opening statement at his news conference at the White House today. It's his second formal news conference in the United States since taking office a year ago. He also did about four other news conferences while traveling overseas and frequently does take a handful of questions from reporters in informal settings. One of the early questions today from a reporter was on the two big priorities from the president stuck in Congress.
Mary Russo, ABC.
Thank you, Mr. President. You mentioned your Republican colleagues, but right now your top two legislative priorities, your social spending package and voting rights legislation, are stalled, blocked by your own party after months of negotiation. You are only guaranteed control of Washington for one more year before the midterms. Do you need to be more realistic and scale down these priorities in order to get something passed?
No, I don't think so. When you say more realistic, I think it's extremely realistic to say to people, because let me back up. You all really know the politics of this country and your networks and others. You spend a lot of time, which I'm glad you do, polling this data, determining where what the American people's attitudes are, et cetera. American people overwhelmingly agree with me on prescription drugs. They overwhelmingly agree with me on the cost of education. They overwhelmingly agree with me on early education. They overwhelmingly go on the list on child care. And so we just have to make the case of what we're for and what the other team's not for. Look, we knew all along that a lot of this was going to be an uphill fight. And one of the ways to do this is to make sure we make the contrast as clear as we can. And one of the things that I think is we're going to have to do is just make the case. I don't think there's anything unrealistic about what we're asking. I'm not asking for castles in the sky. I'm asking for practical things the American people have been asking for a long time, a long time. And I think we can get it done.
President Biden at his news conference at the White House. It ran almost 2 hours. We covered it live on the C-SPAN networks, and you can find the full video at cspan.org. And we'll also have more from this news conference later in this program, Washington Today, as the president talks about Russia threatening Ukraine. But more on the economy and COVID. From the Associated Press, the Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen told a gathering of America's mayors on Wednesday that the Biden administration's coronavirus relief bill was like a vaccine preventing catastrophic economic damage that could have returned the nation to the financial woes seen at the beginning of the pandemic. Yellen talking about the $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan. She spoke at the U.S. Conference of Mayors' 90th winter meeting in downtown Washington, D.C.
When Omicron started spreading around our cities, it did not find them broke and broken. It found them much readier to respond. In some ways, the ARP acted like a vaccine for the American economy, protecting our recovery from the possibility of new variants. Well, the protection wasn't complete, but it was very strong, and it prevented communities from suffering the most severe economic effects of Omicron and Delta. Of course, the relief package did not predict when exactly those variants would emerge, but it did anticipate that our recovery would run up against some unforeseen barriers. The pandemic produced a highly unusual economic crisis, one tied not to the movements of markets, but to the spread and evolution of microbes. The crisis could ebb and flow. It would hit different places in different ways at different times. The state and local fund was designed with that in mind, too. Rather than one burst of money that could only be spent in certain ways, it called for sustained funding. And our Treasury team has worked hard so you can use the money as flexibly as possible.
Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen speaking to mayors attending U.S. Conference of Mayors winter meeting today in Washington. White House announcing today that the Biden administration will make 400 million free, high-quality, non-surgical N95 masks available through pharmacies and community health centers. The masks will come from the government's strategic and national stockpile. And today was the official start of the website covidtest.gov, where Americans can order 4 at-home COVID rapid tests to be delivered by the Postal Service in 7 to 12 days, which will be, as Associated Press writes in its news story, after Omicron cases are expected to peak in many parts of the country. On Capitol Hill, U.S. House Republican leaders holding a news conference to talk about COVID and President Biden's first year handling the pandemic. Congressman Steve Scalise is the minority whip.
Tomorrow marks the one-year anniversary since Joe Biden took the oath of office as President of the United States. And even if you were grading on a curve, by all objective reporting, he would get an F for failing the American people on all the challenges that we're seeing our country face right now. As many of my colleagues here talked about, just start with COVID. This is with the signature campaign platform that Joe Biden ran on. How many times during the campaign did candidate Joe Biden say, I'm going to shut down the virus? He actually bragged that he had a plan on day one to combat the virus. And then what happened just a few weeks ago before governors across the country? He admitted he doesn't have a plan. There is no federal solution, and he dumped it on the governors of our state because he's failed over and over again. There was a bombshell report that came out over the Christmas break that laid out that back in October, President Biden was presented with a plan for testing for all Americans all across the country. 750 million tests for everybody to be ready during Christmas because they predicted there would be this surge. They actually saw it coming. And they presented the plan to Joe Biden, who said he was going to shut down the virus as a candidate. And you know what Joe Biden did in October? He rejected that plan. I wonder if today, when Joe Biden holds his press conference to talk about, he can't talk about any of his accomplishments as president for a year, but he surely should have the opportunity to address whether or not he rejected that plan and why. We've posed this to other administration officials. We haven't gotten an answer yet. Jamie Comer and I asked the heads of the Select Subcommittee on Coronavirus and the Oversight Committee to have a hearing into this testing failure by the Biden administration, and they don't want to have a hearing on it. They seemed overeager to talk about transparency and accountability until all of a sudden they were accountable for more deaths from COVID under the Biden administration than they had when they walked in the door. And let's remember, when Joe Biden took that oath of office a year ago tomorrow, he walked in with President Trump's Operation Warp Speed that had delivered not one, not two, but three proven and effective vaccines. What has President Biden done to advance on that? Nothing. What has he done to go look into more therapeutic options, to look into natural immunity? Again, on testing, the failures that we see where people right now have to wait hours in lines to try to get testing when he was presented with a plan in October and rejected that plan. Kind of hard for him to say now that it should have happened because he was the one who stopped it from happening. Are we having any oversight into the origins of COVID? As Jamie Comer and Jim Jordan pointed out, there are reports out there that Dr. Fauci's advisors, he's got a team of advisors, that some of them were suggesting years ago, that over a year ago, that this started in the lab in Wuhan.
Congressman Steve Scalise, the Republican from Louisiana and House Minority Whip, second in leadership on the House Republican side, news conference with other House Republicans on Capitol Hill Wednesday morning ahead of President Biden's news conference later in the afternoon. A White House email on the president's first year sent out today is titled Fast Facts, Record First in President Biden's First Year. It includes this. President Biden's first year was the greatest year of job creation in American history, with more than 6 million jobs created. The unemployment rate dropped from 6.2% when Biden took office to 3.9%, the biggest single drop in American history. And the average number of Americans filing for unemployment has been near its lowest level since 1969. That was right off the email from the White House. A different take today from Republican Congresswoman Virginia Fox, who is the ranking member of the Education and Labor Committee.
For a year, the Biden administration has struck out on every jobs report. If this were a baseball game, this administration would have been benched long ago. Economists predicted that 450,000 new jobs would be added in the month of December. But what was the result? A dismal 199,000 jobs were added, the worst report of Joe Biden's presidency. Mr. Speaker, with these kinds of numbers, America's economy and workforce will never recover. No matter how this administration spins these failures, one thing is abundantly clear. You cannot swing, miss, and then claim you've hit a home run.
Congresswoman Virginia Fox of North Carolina on the House floor. Wall Street today, the Dow falling 339, NASDAQ down 166, S&P down 44. Senate floor debate on Wednesday was wall-to-wall voting rights and whether to change the filibuster rule. A filibuster requires 60 votes essentially to pass most legislation, but there's a proposal to perhaps change that and allow bills to pass with a lesser amount, specifically the voting rights reform bills. Democrat proposal is to require a so-called talking filibuster. CNBC article explaining the change would force Republican senators to actively speak on the Senate floor to block the legislation rather than withhold their support in a vote. If all senators used up their speeches, each is allowed up to two speeches with no time limit, the chamber could pass proposals with a simple majority. But changing the filibuster rule requires a majority vote. And right now there are 50 Senate Democratic Caucus members, 50 Republican Caucus members, so all in the Democratic side would need to agree. Before the votes in the Senate today, Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat of West Virginia, again said he won't support this.
I believe with every fiber in my body that every eligible citizen of voting age should have the right to vote and be protected by law. Everyone. And I think everyone in here believes the same thing. I truly do. That we should be able to do that. Later today, we're going to vote. And I'm going to vote again to protect that right. And I'm going to be proud to co-sponsor the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Amendment Act. We all have different positions on that, but I'm proud to be part of that. But that's not what we're debating right now. I think we all know that. Right now, we're debating a fundamental change in the Senate rules that will forever alter the way this body functions. For the last year, my Democratic colleagues have taken to the Senate floor, cable news airwaves, pages of newspapers across the country, and to argue that repealing the filibuster is actually restoring the Senate to the vision of the founding fathers intended for this deliberate body. My friends, that is simply not true. It's just not true. The United States Senate has never in 233 years been able to end debate on legislation with a simple majority vote. With a simple majority vote, have never been able to end debate. Could not stop a debate.
Senator Joe Manchin on the Senate floor. Senator Kyrsten Sinema, Democrat of Arizona, has also expressed opposition to changing the filibuster rule. Senator Mark Kelly, Democrat from Arizona as well, was one of the final senators to announce his position. And Wednesday morning, he did say he supports changing the 60-vote threshold for voting rights legislation. You can follow the Senate live gavel to gavel on C-SPAN 2 television at cspan.org and on the free C-SPAN Now mobile app. Supreme Court hearing a case today involving a election campaign. Ted Cruz, senator, a Republican from Texas in 2018. At issue is a campaign finance law that says that campaigns can use money donated after the election to repay candidate loans only up to $250,000. It's a section of the 2002 Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act. The question, does that violate the First Amendment by setting that cap? Cruz put $260,000 of his own money into that campaign, and the following year, as he sought to pay off the debt in excess of the federal limit, he sued the Federal Election Commission. Here's part of today's case. Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Amy Coney Barrett questioning the U.S. Deputy Solicitor General Malcolm Stewart.
How are you supposed to weigh such imponderables such as the marginal burden on the exercise of First Amendment rights against the marginal assistance in preventing corruption? There isn't a sufficient corruption anti-corruption interest sort of up to $250,000, but then all of a sudden there is. Exactly how is that analysis supposed to proceed in concrete terms?
I mean, we don't pretend that it's a bright line rule, but I think we would say two or three different things. The first is there are severe restrictions on gifts to officials in all three branches of the government. So there is an established understanding that the government has a substantial and legitimate interest in preventing the effects that might arise if federal officials were given money that would enrich themselves personally. And the campaign finance laws, in specifying the permissible purposes, the permissible uses of campaign contributions, draw a line between campaign expenditures that will further the purposes of the campaign and campaign expenditures that will benefit the candidate personally.
And why so, Stuart Cruz says that this doesn't enrich him personally because he's no better off than he was before. It's paying a loan, not lining his pockets.
He's certainly no better off than he was before the loan was made, but the whole thrust of his argument is after a loan has been made, there may be a legal entitlement to be repaid, but there will often be practical uncertainty about whether repayment will actually occur. And that uncertainty may be sufficiently burdensome as a practical matter that some candidates will not make the loan at all for fear that they'll be left holding the bag. And so a contributor who eliminates that uncertainty, who pays in the money that ensures that the debt will actually be repaid, is conveying a financial benefit to the candidate, just as if a gift had been made.
Deputy Solicitor General Malcolm Stewart with Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Amy Coney Barrett. Justice Elena Kagan, during today's oral argument, taking a different approach, suggesting that limits on personal loan repayment with political contributions is to prevent a candidate from going over the limits by delaying essentially when the contributions are made. She questioned Charles Cooper, lawyer for the Senator Cruz campaign.
He can spend a gazillion dollars of his own money if he wants to on his campaign, right?
That's true.
So,
by Constitution.
I'm sorry?
Under the First Amendment.
So this restriction, which is a restriction on loan repayment, is really a restriction on how a candidate can use third parties to finance his speech, isn't it?
Your Honor, no more so than any other campaign contribution.
Correct.
Every time.
I think that that's exactly right. It's a restriction on how a candidate can use third parties to finance his speech, which is exactly what contribution limits are. From the candidate's perspective, it's one and the same thing. Is that right?
No, Your Honor. A loan is clearly a form of self-financing by the candidate, obviously to whatever extent that loan is not repaid, it does become a contribution. But the important thing is,
I guess I don't really quite understand the distinction. If this is a restriction on how a candidate can use third parties to finance a speech, not a restriction on how the candidate finances his own speech, but a restriction on third party financing of the campaign, why isn't it completely identical to contribution limits, which we have a well-established law, which is very different from our law respecting expenditures?
Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan questioning Attorney Charles Cooper in today's oral argument in the case Federal Election Commission v. Ted Cruz for Senate. Find the full audio at cspan.org. Supreme Court today also rejecting requests by former President Donald Trump to block the White House records from being sent to the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th Capitol attack. And Chief Justice Roberts issuing a statement in response to an NPR report from Tuesday. That report had said that he had asked all justices to wear face masks during the oral arguments because Justice Sonia Sotomayor, who is diabetic, did not feel safe in close proximity to people who were unmasked due to COVID concerns, and Justice Neil Gorsuch had refused to wear a mask. Chief Justice Roberts' statement today reads, "I did not request Justice Gorsuch or any other justice to wear a mask on the bench." And there was an earlier joint statement from Justice Sotomayor and Justice Gorsuch, which reads, "Reporting that Justice Sotomayor asked Justice Gorsuch to wear a mask surprised us. It is false. While we may sometimes disagree about the law, we are warm colleagues and friends." Washington Today continues in a minute. Welcome back to Washington Today, which you can get as a podcast on the free C-SPAN Now mobile app and wherever you get your podcasts. A story from Reuters, Dateline Kyiv, Ukraine. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said on Wednesday that Russia could launch a new attack on Ukraine at very short notice, but Washington would pursue diplomacy as long as it could. On a visit to Kyiv to show support for Ukraine, the top U.S. diplomat said Ukrainians should prepare for difficult days. He said Washington would keep providing defense assistance to Kyiv and renewed a promise of severe sanctions against Russia in the event of a new invasion. That was from Reuters. Back in Washington, D.C., President Biden asked about this at his White House news conference.
Jen Epstein, Bloomberg.
Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you. Your top foreign policy advisors have warned that Russia is now ready to attack Ukraine, but there's still little unity among European allies about what a package of sanctions against Moscow would look like. If the U.S. and NATO aren't willing to put troops on the line to defend Ukraine and American allies can't agree on a sanctions package, hasn't the U.S. and the West lost nearly all of its leverage over Vladimir Putin? And given how ineffective sanctions have been in deterring Putin in the past, why should the threat of new sanctions give him pause?
Well, because he's never seen sanctions like the ones I promised will be imposed if he moves, number one. Number two, we're in a situation where Vladimir Putin is about to, we've had very frank discussions, Vladimir Putin and I, and the idea that NATO is not going to be united, I don't buy. I've spoken to every major NATO leader. We've had the NATO-Russian summit. We've had other, the OSCE has met, et cetera. And so I think what you're going to see is that Russia will be held accountable if it invades. And it depends on what it does. It's one thing if it's a minor incursion and then we end up having a fight about what to do and not do, et cetera. But if they actually do what they're capable of doing with the force amassed on the border, it is going to be a disaster for Russia if they further invade Ukraine, and that our allies and partners are ready to impose severe cost and significant harm on Russia and the Russian economy. And, you know, we're going to fortify our NATO allies. I told him on the eastern flank, if in fact he does invade, we're going to, I've already shipped over $600 million worth of sophisticated equipment, defensive equipment, to the Ukrainians. The cost of going into Ukraine in terms of physical loss of life for the Russians, they'll be able to prevail over time, but it's going to be heavy. It's going to be real. It's going to be consequential. In addition to that, Putin has a stark choice. He either de-escalation or diplomacy, a confrontation of the consequences. And look, I think you're going to see, for example, everybody talks about how Russia has control over the energy supply that Europe absorbs. Well, guess what? That money that they earn from that makes about 45% of the economy. I don't see that as a one-way street. They go ahead and cut it off. It's like my mother used to say, you're biting your nose off to spite your face. It's not like they have all these wonderful choices out there. I spoke with the Prime Minister of Finland. And, you know, we're talking about concern on the part of Finland and Sweden about what Russia is doing. The last thing that Russia needs is Finland deciding to change its status. They didn't say they're going to do that. But they're talking about what, in fact, is going on and how outrageous Russia is being. We're finding ourselves in a position where I believe you'll see that there'll be severe economic consequences. For example, anything that involves dollar denominations, if they invade, they're going to pay. Their banks will not be able to deal in dollars. So there's a lot's going to happen. But here's the thing. My conversation with Putin, and we've been, how can we say it? We have no problem understanding one another. He has no problem understanding me, nor me him. And the direct conversations were, I pointed out, I said, you know, you've occupied before other countries, but the price has been extremely high. How long? You can go in and over time, at great loss and economic loss, go in and occupy Ukraine, But how many years? 1, 3, 5, 10? What is that going to take? What toll does that take? It's real. It's consequential. So this is not all just a cakewalk for Russia. Militarily, they have overwhelming superiority as it relates to Ukraine. But they'll pay a stiff price immediately, near term, medium term, and long term if they do it.
President Joe Biden at his White House news conference. Secretary of State Antony Blinken confirming today during his visit to Ukraine that the Biden administration approved an additional $200 million in defensive security assistance to Ukraine last month. Today in Washington on Capitol Hill, Senator James Inhofe of Oklahoma, ranking Republican on the Armed Services Committee, says more should have been done sooner.
So we have Russia up there continuing to build up. We know what they're doing. We see every day the Ukrainian borders. The best way the United States can support our friends in Ukraine is to quickly deliver additional aid and bolster Ukraine's defenses. The administration is about 3 months behind where they should be at this time. Sadly, this is history repeating itself. When Russia first invaded Ukraine in 2014, the Obama administration initially failed to send military aid. Only after my colleagues and I sent a legal minimum on funds for lethal defenses, defensive aid, back in 2017, did things really get started. And you might remember that was when we had our defense authorization bill, the NDAA, where we put the legal minimum on funds for lethal defense to make sure that got done. Many of those Obama-era officials, including the president himself, are back in the White House, showing the world that they didn't learn any lessons from 2014. Worse, when the Biden administration had done everything in its power to support the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, that this was going on. This project would line the pockets of Putin. We all know what this would do and the results that they would have. Many of my Democrat colleagues were quick to criticize President Trump, claiming that he didn't do enough initially to push back harder on the Russian aggression. And then now they realize that how much more he did than the Democrats did during their time frame. I'd hoped to pass our bipartisan support for Ukraine. It would continue, but sadly, it has not. Last week, many of my Democrat colleagues opposed the legislation that would have stopped the pipeline.
At Senator James Inhofe, Republican of Oklahoma, with other Senate Republicans at a news conference today on Capitol Hill. He is the ranking member on the Armed Services Committee. This from the German news site Deutsche Welle, speaking virtually to the World Economic Forum in Davos. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz said there was a clear commitment to the territorial integrity of Ukraine. He said, after years of growing tension, silence is not a reasonable option. It was his first forum speech as chancellor, adding that strength of the law must be upheld and not the law of the strongest. The article going on, Scholz became Germany's chancellor in December after 16 years with Angela Merkel at the helm, pledging his center-left-led coalition would offer a new beginning for Europe's top economy. Here's part of the speech.
The last couple of weeks, my first weeks in my new office, have urgently reminded us just how important international cooperation, political exchange, and dialogue are. Take the intensive talks we have been engaging in with Russia since the beginning of January. It is still too early to tell whether they will help de-escalate the situation Russia created by concentrating 100,000 troops along the border with Ukraine. But after years of rising tensions, staying silent is not a sensible option. That is why we are talking to Moscow in a range of different formats. About our commitment to Ukraine's territorial integrity and about a key principle of our common European peace order, that borders must not be moved by force, that right makes might and not the other way around. The Russian side is aware of our determination. I hope they also realized that the gains of cooperation outweigh the price of further confrontation. This is the basis on which we are engaging, because we strongly believe that global public goods can only be preserved through international cooperation, and peace is the most important one of them.
The German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, just in office a month, addressing the World Economic Forum today. It's being held virtually. The Russian embassy in Washington, D.C. tweeted Tuesday night, "We stress once again Russia is not going to attack anyone. The practice of moving troops on our own soil is a sovereign right. We call to end the hysteria and not to pile on tension around the Donbas problem." Donbas is the area of eastern Ukraine where Russian-backed separatists have been fighting Ukrainian forces for years. Reuters in London writes that the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson on Wednesday dismissed calls to resign from opponents and some of his own lawmakers, fighting to save his premiership amid a deepening revolt inside his party over a series of lockdown parties in Downing Street. The lockdowns referring to the restrictions during the early months of the COVID-19 pandemic. The first question today to the Prime Minister during Prime Minister's questions in the House of Commons was from Wendy Chamberlain. She's with the Liberal Democratic Party, not the party of the Prime Minister.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Last year, we were told by the Prime Minister there were no Downing Street parties. Then it turned out there were parties, but we were assured that no rules were broken. Last week, we heard that rules may have been broken, but that he thought it was a work event. And now yesterday, from the man who wrote the rules, it was, "Well, nobody told me what those rules were." Mr. Speaker, 5 weeks ago, the people of North Shropshire were clear, and the people of North East Fife are being clear to me now. No matter the excuse, there is no excuse for taking the British people for fools. Will the Prime Minister agree it is now time for him to resign?
No, Mr. Speaker, but what I can tell her is that, as I said to the House last week, I apologise sincerely for any misjudgments that were made, but she must contain her impatience, Mr. Speaker, and wait for the inquiry next week before she draws any of the conclusions that she's just asserted.
The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, questioned by Member of Parliament Wendy Chamberlain, a Lib Dem. A few in the Prime Minister's own party, the Conservatives, also calling for his resignation. Here's the question and Prime Minister's questions from David Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Like many on these benches, I spent weeks and months defending the Prime Minister against often angry constituents. I reminded them of his success in delivering Brexit and on the vaccine and many other things. But I expect my leaders to shoulder the responsibility for the actions they take. Yesterday, he did the opposite of that. So I'll remind him of a quotation altogether too familiar to him of Leo Amery to Neville Chamberlain. "You have sat there too long for all the good you have done. In the name of God, go."
Order. Prime Minister.
I must say to the Right Honourable Gentleman, I don't know what he's talking about, but what I can tell him, I don't know what quotation he's alluding to that he's referring to, but what I can tell him is that I think I've told this House repeatedly throughout this pandemic, I take full responsibility for everything done in this government and throughout the pandemic.
Headline at Business Insider reads, "Boris Johnson's political death is near," claim Conservative MPs, suspecting that no confidence letters are piling up. Joining us now from London is the senior United Kingdom political editor for Business Insider, Catherine Nealon. Thanks for being with us. What's the latest on this situation?
Well, it's been another huge day in Westminster, but I have to say that at the end of it, things perhaps might be a little bit calmer than they were this time last night. The word febrile has been used sort of to the point where it's now becoming a bit of a joke. But last night, MPs were texting, ministers were briefing and counter-briefing, and it all felt a bit like Westminster had kind of lost its head. And then today we had a Conservative MP, one of the newest MPs in Parliament, Christian Wakeford, say that he was leaving to join the Labour Party, the opposition. Now, this is potentially a big moment. But actually what it seems to have done is kind of temporarily kind of acted as a valve release and sort of allowed people to go, okay, right, this is what we're really talking about now. But in the same sort of hour of parliamentary debate, the Prime Minister's questions, which is the biggest kind of ticket of the week, we also had David Davis, a very senior Conservative MP who was a Brexit secretary and resigned because he didn't like what Theresa May's Brexit deal looked like. He stood up and told Boris he has to go. And the interesting sort of way that he used this quote was that it was a quote that a person had used to Neville Chamberlain, famously the Prime Minister before Churchill. And Boris has always kind of likened himself or wanted to liken himself to Winston Churchill. So it's quite a cutting position, quote to use, to compare him to Churchill's predecessor.
In the headline, we mentioned no confidence letters. Explain, what's the process for removing a British Prime Minister?
Yeah, I've seen people compare it to a sort of grief of teenage girls a little bit, but it's slightly arcane. With the Conservative Party, whereby there is a person, in this case his name is Sir Graham Brady, and he will receive these letters of no confidence in secret. We kind of say that they're kept in his safe, and only he and not even his wife knows how many there are until the threshold is reached, and that is 15% of the MPs at the time, which at the minute is 54 Tory backbenchers. So until that point, it's a bit like Schrodinger's cat. We don't know whether it's alive, whether it's dead. But once that threshold has been reached, that will formally trigger a leadership contest or a vote of no confidence. And if Boris loses that vote of no confidence, that will trigger a leadership contest. If he wins, and actually at the minute, I would say he's probably more likely to win than not, he is granted protection. So no one is allowed to vote for him for, I think it's a year. So it's quite high stakes. If you kind of vote him and you go and you lose, then he's won for another year.
This all seems to be happening very fast. What was the British public's reaction when they heard about these parties?
Well, the parties story has been sort of drip feeding for several weeks, and actually I would say probably it all kicked off with Boris Johnson's elated attempt to save a colleague, Owen Paterson, who was making a 6-week suspension breaking lawyering rules. He sent the whips out, which meant that Tory MPs were being told that they had to vote with the government on this, which is very unusual and upset a lot of people. And after that, there were leaks, there were stories, there was a lot of questions about Tory sleaze, which is the sort of narrative that has been, you know, hard fought against over the last sort of 20, 30 years, you know, for the Red Wall MPs, the Conservative MPs that have won Labour heartlands. They have had to fight hard to get rid of the sleaze reputation, and that is back. And then on the back of that, we had Christmas parties. Now, the potentially big political issue for Boris is not that he was at the Christmas parties, but that he attended one in May of 2020 when the UK was under one of its toughest lockdowns. And at that time, you were only allowed to meet one other person outdoors who wasn't a part of your household. Now, Boris Johnson's defence so far has been he didn't realise that it was a party. He thought it was a work event. And he said yesterday, again, nobody told me that it was against the rules. But, you know, big questions are being asked about how someone who is effectively setting the rules can claim he didn't know what was against the rules.
So how do you think this will all turn out?
Yeah, so this is the $64 million question. Will he survive? And actually, the sense is that there is stability to his ultimate demise. Resignation and sort of, as I wrote in my article today, that his political death will come. The question is whether it will be a fast death or a slow death. The fast death is that he loses a vote of no confidence. That would trigger a leadership contest. He would be gone. The Conservatives in 6 months' time will have a new prime minister, new leader, and that will be people hope enough for them to then win the next election, whenever that comes, 2024 is likely. The sort of more protracted version is that it rumbles on. He wins the vote of no confidence and, you know, they're back there in a year. But if that happens, Labour and the other opposition parties will be able to make an enormous amount of political capital out of the fact that the Tories don't want to get rid of this man who is seen as leading a sort of culture in Number 10 where it's disrespectful to the Queen, it's disrespectful to everyone else that's been following the rules, they don't care. This message that there's one rule for them and one rule for everyone else is a very strong attack line that has really been cutting through with people.
Catherine Nealon is with Business Insider, joining us from London. They're senior political editor in the United Kingdom. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
And Prime Minister Boris Johnson announcing today that the COVID restrictions that were known as Plan B are going to end next Thursday. Mandatory face coverings in public places and COVID passports. Johnson also telling members of Parliament that scientists believe the Omicron variant wave in the United Kingdom has peaked. The pro hockey player that broke the color barrier in the National Hockey League in 1958, Willie O'Ree, is going to be awarded the Congressional Gold Medal. The U.S. House passed the bill unanimously today. The Senate passed it last summer, so it will be going to President Biden for his expected signature into law. O'Ree played for the Boston Bruins, and on the House floor today, this from Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts.
64 years ago, in the midst of the fight to end Jim Crow, Willie O'Ree made history with the Boston Bruins by becoming the first black player to play in the National Hockey League. A descendant of enslaved people who escaped the horrors of slavery through the Underground Railroad, Willie was born and raised in New Brunswick, Canada, and was the youngest of 13 children. His love of the game began at the young age of 3, where he earned his stripes playing alongside his older siblings. Known as the Jackie Robinson of hockey, Willie played 45 games in the NHL and spent more than 2 decades playing professional hockey, all while hiding the fact that he was nearly completely blind in one eye. Willie O'Ree was a young and fast left winger, but he could not outskate the racist backlash in response to his desegregating the National Hockey League. As the sole black player in the NHL at the time, Willie endured relentless bigotry, racism, discrimination, and even violence from fans and players, both on and off the ice. And despite it all, Willie embodied resilience, grace, dignity, and never gave up on the determination to live out his dream. In the decades following his historic career on the ice, Willie has spent his time paying it forward to the next generation of icebreakers. As the NHL's Director of Youth Development and a Diversity Ambassador, he has worked to increase opportunities for young black and brown players so that they too can take their rightful place in the big league.
Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, Democrat from Massachusetts, on the House floor. Again, this bill to give the Congressional Gold Medal to Willie O'Ree passed the House unanimously today, and it will be signed into law. It already passed the Senate last summer. Willie O'Ree was inducted into the Hockey Hall of Fame in 2018, and this week, the Boston Bruins retired his jersey number. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. For more of Washington's top stories, subscribe to C-SPAN's evening newsletter, Word for Word. Go to c-span.org/connect to subscribe. And have a good night.